wedding, and it's in re marriage of Julia M. Meyer and Joseph D. Meyer, representing Julia Meyer is Sabina Bossert. Attorney Bossert, you may proceed.
Your Honor, here with me today is my client, Julia Myers, the petitioner in this action. And Julia and her former husband, Dr. Joseph Meyer, are before you today on two questions of law relating to their divorce. Can a trial court consider premarital contributions to the attainment of a degree under 767 and or compensate one for such contributions under the unjust enrichment theories developed in Watts? The parties to this action met in March of 1985. They began an exclusive relationship a year later. Julia was a licensed nurse, and Joe began his first year of college. They moved in together. Dr. Meyer went through the rest of his college and medical school career while Julia supported him on a full-time basis. In 1986, 1 year after they began living together, Julia received a promise ring from Dr. Meyer signifying their mutual commitment and an engagement ring 2 or 3 years later. There was no question that they intended to marry and have children, and they did marry and have children. And there was no question that they intended to use the economic benefits resulting from Dr. Meyer's medical degree to finance their lives together and to make their lives more comfortable into the future. In 1993, after they had lived together for 7 years, they did marry. Julia had a baby. She continued to work full time. She provided most of the household chores and the child care and allowed Dr. Meyer to continue to pursue the long hours required of his residency. After 4 years of marriage, the parties separated, and after 5.5 years, they were divorced. Though they lived frugally, the high cost of Dr. Meyer's education left the couple with little opportunity to accumulate assets. Beyond the medical degree, which they both worked so hard for, both contributed to the realization of that degree. Mrs. Meyer, with her financial, homemaking, and child-raising contributions, and Dr. Meyer with his attention to his studies. The trial court awarded a slightly unequal property division in Julia's favor, given the fact that the parties had little to divide after years of Dr. Meyer's unemployment and the high cost of books and tuition. And the court additionally awarded Julia 8 years of spousal maintenance, in part to compensate her for the contributions to Dr. Meyer's education and increased earning capacity. The trial court also stated that it believed that Julia could succeed on her unjust enrichment claim as well, but 767.255 and .26 adequately allowed the court to consider the entirety of the party's relationship to compensate Julia. The trial court therefore felt that it was unnecessary to award a separate award under the inequitable unjust enrichment claim.
Counsel, I'm just wondering, and maybe this is a question you're going to answer further on down, but we have the legislative policy of encouraging marriage. We have the statute. We have the intent of the statute. And I'm just wondering, if we're going to say to the trial court, now you can go back, use your discretion, go back as far as you want. I'm just wondering how far they can go back. Is it during the dating period? Is it here they happen to live together? But is it before that time? Is there any clear lines that this court should be developing? Because I do have some concern over, first of all, you have a policy that has been very, I think, well articulated by the legislature, favoring marriage. Then you have the statute, 767. You have, now you're saying it should be fairness, it should be equitable. Where is that line? Is it a fuzzy line, or is there somewhere we can draw that line? Or is it just up to how, in this case, the judge called it? And if there has not been an erroneous exercise, are we bound to follow that?
I think that there is a fairly clear guideline for the court, both in your own findings in the Watts case, which described the unjust enrichment claim as requiring compensation for a benefit conferred, an understanding that a benefit was being conferred, the benefit was accepted, and the compensation was not forthcoming.
Yeah,
under 767...
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Under 767, that same thinking is clearly set forth under subdivision 8 of 767.26, the maintenance portion of the statute, which provides that the court is to consider when setting maintenance any mutual agreement made by the parties before or during the marriage according to the terms of which one party has made financial or service contributions to the other with the expectation of reciprocation or other compensation in the future where such repayment has not been made, and so on. And so I would answer you that it has really little to do with the fact that they're together. It has to do with the benefit conferred. The trial court needs to look at whether a benefit has been conferred wherein there was a reasonable expectation of compensation. The mere fact that they were dating or together would have little to do with whether there was this understanding that they had and whether a benefit was conferred.
Counsel, how do you value the degree? What approach do you take to put a value on the medical degree?
This court has, in both Lundberg and again in Halvin, discussed that in great detail. In Halvin, the court gave four very specific scenarios for evaluation. One had to do with the cost to the person giving the benefit. The other had to do with the benefit received, the income stream, the present value of that income stream by the other, the cost of the education itself, relating that back to the duration of the marriage, the foregone opportunities of the person giving the benefit. I think really what this court has said is that the statute allows the court to fashion an equitable resolution in each individual case. And it suggests several concrete ways to value the degree, but leaves it up to the trial court in each unique case to determine what makes sense in that case.
Do we have to overrule the DeWitt case? Isn't DeWitt the one that says that the degree is not an asset?
I don't think you have to overrule DeWitt at all. DeWitt was pre-767, the current divorce law. And when this court decided Lundberg, the court stated that it was not overruling DeWitt because it felt that DeWitt wasn't relevant to findings under 767 because the statute hadn't been in place when that case was determined. And therefore, I think DeWitt kind of becomes a non sequitur in this proceeding because we are now under 767. Or if this court decided that a court should make two different awards, one based on the period prior to the marriage and one based during the marriage, you would follow the thinking of Watts, which is the case that this court decided, which established the concept of unjust enrichment. I don't think it makes a lot of sense when parties do finally marry to look to the unjust enrichment provisions of Watts and fashion two separate awards. But Judge Gonzalez, at the trial court level in this case, acknowledged the fact that that was within the power of the court, but that it didn't make much sense to do it when the court had the power under 767 to look back, and I won't recite again, the mutual agreements made by the parties before and during the marriage. And I would also point out that the section of both the property division and maintenance statutes refer to the contribution by one party to the education, training, or increased earning power of the other. And again, there's no reference to the time frame, and it either before or after the marriage. The mutual agreement specifically refers to before. So I think there is plenty of statutory authority for the court to fashion the result that Judge Gonzalez made at the trial court level in this case.
But if we get to, if we handle it under the first issue, basically under fairness and equity and the contribution, we don't even really have to get to unjust enrichment, do we?
No.
We just say that the judge had this power that she did not, there was not an erroneous exercise of her discretion, and took these factors and that they're laid out in the statute and not deal with the other part.
You don't have to, and I realize that it's the desire of the court usually to narrowly decide things to the degree possible. In this particular case, though, because the Court of Appeals has said with such pronouncement that they cannot put a value on a degree in an unjust enrichment case, it seems so ripe for you to comment on that. That really would seem to be, I think, a burden to litigants in the future not to have your wisdom on that subject now.
I have several issues. One, if I remember Haugen, you could value the contribution for either a maintenance or a property division. Isn't that right?
That's true, and you did that under Lumberg also. But the difference between Lumbering and Haugen was that in Haugen, you really specifically gave advice on how to do the valuation. Lumbering just said, put some value on it. It didn't really describe that clearly how.
Okay, that number one. Number two, there's a catch-all in 767. It lists 9 criteria or standards or factors to be considered and then says anything else that's fair.
Yes.
So I had expected, maybe I just missed it in reading your brief, that that would be what you'd rely on because it's a catch-all and I don't remember a case that it says such other factors that the court may in each individual case determine to be relevant. So there's nothing here that prohibits a court from considering premarital.
No, and that is so obvious, I guess, that I didn't make that big a point of it, because there are the very specific directions under the mutual agreement section and under the education section that are so specific that in this case we don't even need to reach for the catch-all. We have some specific direction.
Okay, and then I have a third question, and that is, seems to me you'd want to, the court would want to make this as simple as possible for trial courts to put into effect. So what's the difference whether we say you do it under 767 and you have, this as a consideration of the trial court, or you say, no, can't be done under 767, but you put it in under unjust enrichment. The divorce court's going to handle both, I assume. I mean, you would not want two separate trials, right?
Yes.
Okay. No one's claiming that it can't be handled by the divorce court, as far as I can remember.
The Court of Appeals merely stated that the court couldn't find that a degree was an asset. It didn't say that some other kind of unjust enrichment, but that really would have become pretty irrelevant because if it were a different kind of piece of property, they had no premarital agreement, it would have been subject to division anyway.
Well, that's my point. So my ultimate point is we may be disputing, other than the valuation of the asset, that the dispute as to whether you consider it under 767 or you consider it under unjust enrichment may not make much difference.
I don't think it makes much difference, but I think that it's nice to say that 767 rules married parties.
Well, my next question is, I'm trying to decide which way, since the state fosters marriage, I mean, that's a public policy, which decision of the court is most fostering of marriage? If you say that any pre-marriage property relationships or financial relationships are not considered on divorce, then would people say, hey, I'm not getting married because I'm going to get hurt by this? So is it a marriage penalty if you say the trial court can't consider pre-marriage? And that raises Justice Wilcox's question. Here you might have a sharp defining line of them moving in and living together. You may have much more blurred lines of somebody who's dating seriously and gives somebody money to help them along, because the long run, the expectation is marriage. So it may not be as sharp as in this case. So is this a marriage penalty if we don't put it into 767?
I think that to not compensate Julia in this situation would encourage someone not to marry. If you can induce someone to support you and contribute to your attaining of a degree and maintain that to yourself if you don't marry them, that would encourage you to do that, knowing that if you do marry them, you will have to share that.
Well, if you stay with the Court of Appeals, you don't have to share.
This court has already...
Another way of putting that, why, if we rule against you, why would a person in Julia's position ever marry Joe?
Why do people marry? They marry...
In terms of
we won't get into that.
Obviously, I'm not asking. I'm talking in terms of pure economic sense. If she remains unmarried, she can... We have got cases that say that they can divide the accumulated assets. But if she does get married, we rule against you. So why would Julia want to marry from an economic standpoint?
Well, we don't have cases that say... yet that this is an asset. So if she didn't marry him, then she would not get the benefit of her bargain. According to the Court of Appeals, under an unjust enrichment claim, a degree is not an asset. I don't think, though I understand that the Court of Appeals says it can't overrule itself, I don't understand why they believe that sticking with DeWitt and Greenwald in that line of cases has to be overruled in order to accept the concept that an income stream created by an education is in fact an asset. They accept the fact that this court has established the concept that one is to be compensated for the unjust enrichment of the other. And yet they carve out this one type of benefit and say, yes, that's clearly a great benefit to this fellow, but we're going to say that isn't an asset. There's not much logic to that.
Well, it's not tangible. That's really what their dividing line is. Isn't that correct? You have tangible and intangible?
We have many intangible assets that are divided. When we value a going concern business, we put blue sky on it, and we put value on it, and we transfer that, and we pay one party who keeps it or who doesn't keep it. And we put value in appraisals every day on intangible assets.
I'm not saying that you can't value it. In fact, it's Hagen that gives you how to value
yes.
it. So we can value it. There are four ways to value it. but I am saying that, as I understand the majority of the Court of Appeals, they're saying that even though it can be valued, Hagen shows you how to value, that a degree is not an asset. And if it's not an asset, then you cannot maintain a cause of action for unjust enrichment. Isn't that the Court of Appeals?
Yes, they're saying that, and they're relying on their own finding in DeWitt, which this court, in a way, made moot by the finding of this court in Lumber.
I have a problem, and I need your help on this. I think of unjust enrichment, a cause of action that we'd see on occasion. I don't have a lot of experience with unjust enrichment, but I've had some experience with unjust enrichment. I always go to the jury instructions, and indeed the jury instructions show that it's a benefit conferred. Number one, these are the elements. Number two, knowledge or appreciation of the benefit. Number three, acceptance, retention, etc. Those are the elements. Now, Watts, which is the case that's most discussed in your briefs, cites the jury instructions, cites the elements of unjust enrichment, and says in order to have a cause of action, you need these three elements. How do we then get the Court of Appeals decisions in Ward and Waage, W-A-A-G-E, that say Watts said you need three other elements to maintain a cause of action? In other words, as I read Ward and Waage, they say that there are three elements to unjust enrichment in a non-marital cohabitation situation. That is, number one, an accumulation of assets. However, Watts and the jury instructions say number one, to maintain a cause of action, is a benefit. The Court of Appeals in Ward and Waage said the second element to maintain a cause of action is that the assets have to be acquired through the efforts of the claimant and other parties. The second element of unjust enrichment is knowledge or appreciation under Watts and jury instruction. I mean, how can Ward and Waage change the elements of unjust enrichment when for every other context it is the three elements cited by Watts and set forth in jury instructions? How did they accomplish that?
I think they accomplish it by making the leap when this court uses the word asset and benefit interchangeably in both Lumberg and Watts. They latch on to the word asset and ignore the word benefit. And I think that the facts were so different in those cases that the result may have made some sense, and they weren't really forced to confront the distinction between the concept of asset and benefit. But I agree with you. We're talking about benefit. That's what
they have to overrule Ward and Waage. Are they distinguished? They note that it seems to me that the dissent in the Court of Appeals distinguishes cases and doesn't overrule cases.
I think that Waage says on its face, benefit alone does not constitute unjust enrichment. So perhaps Waage would not be on all fours with what I'm suggesting the trial court has done and what I would hope that this court upholds. You're absolutely right. This playing with words, this difference without a distinction, this asset versus benefit concept is very apparent in the Court of Appeals cases.
Now, Waage says, our case, that was in Waage, to the jury was that Waage retained a benefit because of her uncompensated housekeeping efforts made in contemplation of marriage. Under Watts, her case must fail. Bauer presented absolutely no evidence of assets accumulated.
Exactly.
Well, in Watts, it was much of her bookkeeping and
there was much discussion of services, but in the end, they had a business.
That's right.
Made it simpler. It was concrete, what had been developed.
Well, in the end, in this case, there's a medical degree.
It is a medical degree.
Stream of income, potential.
Right. But this court has spent a lot of time discussing how you value.
The maintenance payments in this case were premised in part on permitting Mrs. Meyer to go back to school for additional education. Is that right?
The court stated that it would give her the opportunity to do that. It didn't premise them on. It talked in terms of compensation, reasonable opportunity and compensation. And it also didn't really distinguish between the value of the services provided before and after the marriage, but stated that the court, bringing all of it together, felt that this was equitable. There was, in the property division, the trial court in this case gave a somewhat uneven property division, but $45,000 of the debt that Juliet took were tuition loans. So Dr. Meyer didn't have any trouble making that debt, which was solely related to his education, a part of the balance sheet in the divorce.
Cool. Could I follow up? Let me try to speak abstractly, but when a person gets maintenance payments under circumstances like these, do they have any obligation to follow up on education?
I don't think so, because I think that the family court already is too burdened with sort of running people's lives. And to add that extra burden to the trial court, not only to give a person an opportunity, but to sort of take a parental role to see if they really took advantage of the opportunity, I think is something that there is no public policy benefit to. Things may change. Sometimes if you stay in a job, that's worth more to an income stream than a master's degree, and that's a decision a person needs to make.
Mrs. Meyer did follow up and get an advanced degree, got a fabulous job, making $500,000 a year. Is there any claim for unjust enrichment here by Dr. Meyer?
No, because he is merely compensating her for what she did for him. They're getting even for what they did back in that 7 years or 14 years. This isn't something extra he's giving her into the future. It has to do with the relationship they had when they were together. So what she does with that recompense would be her business, just as if I give you $100, you pay me back the $100, I put it in the stock market and make $1 million, you would have no relationship to that.
She advanced in the, quote, insurance company or whatever, and she became a vice president of the insurance company, that the doctor would be entitled to no recompense?
I don't think so, because I think
it's all based on getting a degree in whatever job she had. If she advanced in that job and became company president, there would be no compensation.
No, I don't think there would, because I think that the concept
is that fair?
Yes, I think it's fair, because the concept is giving her recompense for what they did together.
If he wanted to potentially share in that, he'd have to leave maintenance open, right?
Yes.
And if he doesn't leave maintenance open, then that's finished as to maintenance. So she could win the lottery and it's gone,
right,
as far as he's concerned. If he left maintenance open, then he could share in terms of maintenance.
He could, and I think this court, I think it's a Supreme Court case, has stated that the court has to have a good reason for leaving maintenance open.
Right. Now, in this case, there is maintenance for 7 years for her.
Eight.
And the assumption then is at the end of that time, maintenance is completed, and if she got her degree and did better, that's fine. If she doesn't have her degree and doesn't get better, that's the end of maintenance.
She had her opportunity.
That's right. And that's how it's set up. Now, I just can't remember. Can she come in within the 8 years and extend that time period?
She could, but there would have to be something that the court could not possibly have expected to happen, and I don't know what that would be.
Well, if she gets seriously ill,
yes,
or some tragedy befalls, or
yes,
whether or not she went to college, etc.
It would have to be something that the court could not have contemplated at the time.
Okay, so that's why neither one beyond that 7 years, or 8 years, I'm sorry, shares in the wealth or hardship.
Yes.
Because of the maintenance statutes.
Right, because this maintenance contribution isn't based on a long-term dependency concept of maintenance, which is a different type of maintenance.
Justice Brett.
No further questions.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Bossard.
Thank you.
You've used your time. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. We will now hear from Attorney Ryan, who represents Joseph D. Meyer. Or is it Meyer?
It's Meyer, Your Honor.
Meyer, okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. Ms. Bossert, may it please the Court. I'm Dan Ryan, and I'm representing Joseph Meyer in this case, which I agree presents two issues to you this morning. The first issue, whether or not the trial court erred in applying Chapter 767 to a period of premarital cohabitation and awarding maintenance based on that premarital cohabitation. The second issue is whether, in the alternative, the trial court could have used unjust enrichment to justify a maintenance award. I will first address the first question, the question of whether Chapter 767 applies to a period of premarital cohabitation. And I think when you're looking at this statute, Chapter 767, you start with the intent of the legislature, and there is a clear statement about the legislative intent in 765.001. That section of the statute indicates that it's the intent of the legislature to value contributions of both spouses, and it specifically limits that to during the marriage. That phrase appears in that portion of the statute that is setting forth the legislative intent, clearly limiting the application, the contributions made during the marriage. The legislature is making a distinction here between contributions made during the marriage and contributions made before the marriage. What the trial court did in this case was to interpret the statutes in a way that is inconsistent with that particular statement of legislative intent. The trial court looked at the statutes, which I agree, some of which do not contain a specific limitation indicating during the marriage.
Counsel, just on that point, what when you look at 767.26 in maintenance, there is no limiting language in 9 and 10, and so the legislature, you're talking about the preamble first, but then in the actual statute, 767.26, they neglected to put any limiting language in, and it says that such other factors as the court may in each individual case determine to be relative. Relevant.
That's correct.
So the
Is
there a conflict there?
I don't believe there's a conflict. I believe that the statute is silent on that issue, but also in the preamble there is a section that talks about the statutes having to be interpreted in a manner that's consistent with the purpose for which they're passed. And when you look at the factors that you referred to and look at them in context with that purpose, that legislative intent to value contributions made during the marriage, that's where the limitation comes up, I think.
Your opposing counsel would argue in response to that, look at the factors set forth in 767.26. Some of the factors have limiting language, such as sub 4 specifically, which says the educational level of each party at the time of the marriage and at the time the action is commenced. Those two points encompass during the marriage. The argument, contrary then, advanced against your position, is look at sub 9, and that's in part what the trial court relied on, which is the contribution by one party to the education, training, or increased earning capacity of the other. And the trial court said, look, that doesn't have any limitation. It doesn't say during the marriage, or it doesn't give the outer limits of the period. In fact, it would be surplusage if 9 meant the same as 4 to even have 9. That's the argument. How do you respond to that? Both, if they wanted to put it in, they would have, as the trial court said, the language isn't there in limitation in sub 9, and that sub 9 is surplusage if both 4 and 9 are only encompassing the period of time of the marriage.
As I read the statute, the only one that has the limitation, the specific limitation, is 4, which you mentioned. I don't see any others that talk about limiting during the marriage.
Well, others, for instance, sub 8, specifically, right, when it says before or during the marriage. That's what sub 8 apparently means. Sub 4 apparently means during the marriage. Sub 1 is the marriage, you know, which is apparently the marriage. And yet 9 and 10 don't have those kind of limitations.
That's correct. I don't believe that it's surplusage. I think if I answer the second question, I think it would answer the first question too. You're talking about two different ways that you can consider the fact that a person may have attained a degree during the marriage. 4 talks about the educational level at the beginning and at the end. You're not considering at all contributions made by one party to the degree. It's just what the person had in terms of education when it started, what the person had at the end.
Well, isn't that, maybe I'm wrong, but I think inherent, the very reason that you measure not just at the end, what are they ending up with, but what did they start with, means what did they gain during this marriage? You started out as an LPN, and you end up as a nurse anesthetist. You know, what did you gain during the marriage? And does number 9 say the same? I mean, with your interpretation, number 9 would say the same thing. What was gained during the marriage in terms of educational advancement?
Right. And the way I read this, the first one talks about simply educational enhancement, which the trial court can consider. 9 talks about contributions above and beyond the fact that one person was able to further their degree. What did the other spouse do to contribute towards that? You know, did they pay money towards tuition? Did they carry the load more at home while the other person was off getting her or his degree? That's the way that I read those two, and I think that in both cases, even in Section 9, which doesn't carry the specific limitation that you're talking about, because you're always going back to the intent of the legislature. You're talking about valuing that contribution as it occurred during the marriage.
Counsel, let's move to one of these factors that I find interesting, because it does refer to conduct before marriage. And that's factor 8.
Correct.
Now, why is it not reasonable to assume that there was an implicit agreement between Joe and Julia that she would work while he was going to school, and then following his schooling and his employment, that they would together reap the benefits of that? I mean, that to me seems like the most logical, reasonable thing. Maybe they didn't sit down and write it out or even talk about it, but this factor 8 does not preclude an implicit agreement. And on the facts of this case, it sure looks to me like an implicit agreement.
I would disagree with that. I don't think there was an implicit agreement. There was testimony given, I believe, by Julia, saying that this was what she expected. There was finding by the trial court saying, yes, she expected this. There was no testimony by Julia saying that she knew that Joe expected it to. There was no testimony by Joe saying that he expected it.
Well, Joe didn't testify to the contrary, did he? Joe didn't say, I didn't expect this.
I don't believe he testified to the contrary, but I think when you're trying to...
But it doesn't defy logic. I mean, I can't imagine Joe saying, no, I was going to leave the relationship after she helped me out. That's
right.
The way normal, that's not the way things happen in the normal course of events.
And I think what you're touching on is the fact that sometimes these agreements are made, but
usually they're implicit.
Right. And sometimes they are, but to get back to subsection 8, which talks about mutual agreements made before or during the marriage, it goes on to say, according to the terms of which one party has made financial or service contributions to the other with the expectation of reciprocation. I believe that interpreting the part about one party making financial or service contributions to the other consistently with the intent of the legislature, you're talking about a situation where two people agree to get married, either before the marriage or during the marriage. They say to each other, okay, you know, you will go to school and I will support you during that time and I'll pay you back when we're done. But you're talking about contributions, financial and service contributions, during the marriage. If you're limiting it in the way that the legislature intended that to be limited. Otherwise, you're talking about basically a breach of contract claim. Why put it in the divorce code anyway if it talks about what's happening before the marriage or outside the marriage? I think that, you know, in interpreting that consistently with the intent of the legislature, that section, when it talks about the contributions, is talking about contributions made during the marriage.
Well, what about subsection 10? That's a broad broad section. Covers anything that wasn't set forth, or even if it was set forth. And the other nine, it just says any other factors. Why can't this be under 10?
Because it's inconsistent with what the legislature intended. They intended to value contributions made during the marriage.
Where does it say that?
This is in 765.001, parent 2. It says it is the intent of the legislature to recognize the valuable contributions of both spouses during the marriage and at termination of the marriage by dissolution or death. In the preamble, Your Honor.
So you think that says we don't intend to include anything before marriage, so anything between engagement and marriage, any gifts made or any support done, that's out.
I think it's clear that that's what they're intending to do, and you know, this may be why when they went through the maintenance statutes, they didn't specifically limit each one.
Tell me, what difference does it make? And set aside this case, we have an argument about what an asset is. But
okay.
Let's just take another case where they buy stocks and bonds, clearly an asset.
Right.
Bought with earnings of one of the parties pre-marriage. Okay. Both, in effect, helped acquire that asset. That would fit under quantum merit, wouldn't it? Quasi-contract. Under what?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
Right.
If there's a yes.
So if this were a case of stocks and bonds instead of a medical degree,
right.
You would say that the divorce court can determine maintenance and or property division on the basis of this, of everything after marriage and on quantum merit for everything before marriage, right?
That's right.
So what difference would it make? In the long run, in that case, it would make no difference, I suggest.
Whether or not
Yeah, whether you divide it quantum merit or under the marriage, because they're both equitable kinds of resolutions.
Well, I think that the court in the family court would be limited by the factors set forth that the statute says it can consider when it's considering property division. But if you're saying
any
that...
any other factors under 10.
That's correct. And if you're saying that all of it would get divided one way or the other by when you talk about both theories,
right.
I agree with that.
Under equitable consideration. They're both equitable.
Both would be divided, but I don't think that the law of unjust enrichment is the same as when the court applies unjust enrichment. It doesn't have to consider the factors set forth in 767.255. So I think the court is applying different rules to the division of the asset.
Okay, so you think it could be a different result?
I think it could be.
So would you suggest if a client came to you and said, I've been living with this man for 5 years and we've acquired this stock which has appreciated, 600%, 800%, and now we're going to, I'm thinking of getting married, but I'm worried about what would happen if there's a divorce. Statistics show that I gather one out of two, one out of three, whatever it is, marriages end in divorce. So what do you suggest, counsel, other than a premarital agreement, which I really don't think we're ready to do, if we get married, am I going to be hurt financially?
I guess I would ask questions about whose name the stock was being held in. I assume in your example it's not being held in her name?
That's right.
Okay, it's in the other person's name.
Like the medical degree.
Right. And she's worried about how to protect herself so that if they're divorced, he doesn't get the entire asset.
Because now we'd go under quantum merit, mm-hmm. maybe.
I think that Watts would cover a situation like that, where the two parties together worked to accumulate an asset.
Okay.
And you've got an asset that can be readily divided. Person can simply say, okay, we'll sell it and I'll give you half. Or the court can say that. When you're talking about a degree or something like that, it isn't an asset that Dr. Meyer can say tomorrow, well, I'm going to sell my medical degree and I'll just give you 20% of what it's worth or 30% of what.
Well, they did it in Haugen.
They did do it in Haugen, but I think when you talk about Haugen, when you talk about Lundberg, when you talk about Roberto, you're always talking about the court looking at the maintenance statute, looking at property division statutes, looking at those factors and finding within those factors a flexible method of valuing a person's contribution to a degree like that.
How can Haugen and DeWitt live together? I mean, aren't they they're just internally and externally?
Does that suggest?
Yes, they cannot cohabitate, as Justice Bradley suggests. How can that be? Here in Haugen and Roberto, the court says, hey, this is an important, call it what you will, asset, stream of income, and you consider it for either maintenance or property division or both. And not only can you consider it either way, but you can, you have four ways of valuing it. I mean, that's as broad as you can get.
Within the context of a marriage, and as long as the support is provided during
the
marriage.
But how then, how does it sit with DeWitt, which says it's not an asset, you can't divide it, you can't value it. I'm scanning Haugen again, and I see that, I think, it may not have even been mentioned.
It was mentioned, I believe, in not the DeWitt case, but there was a dissent that said, or I believe it was a concurring opinion that said, I don't agree with what the court did here. I think we should just go ahead and value this as an asset and divide it that way.
Doesn't rely on DeWitt, just because it doesn't like the third formula.
I agree. And I think that DeWitt is saying that a degree is not an asset.
That's right. How does that fit with Haugen? Wasn't DeWitt in effect with Haugen and was it Lundberg that Bauckes wrote?
Lundberg, right.
Yeah. How do they fit? I don't understand it.
In DeWitt, the court is saying that you cannot value a degree as an asset. In Haugen and Lundberg, the court is saying, well, we're going to look at the divorce statute, and we're going to find a flexible way to value contributions to degrees. I don't believe that the court in Haugen, in fact, the court in Haugen stops short of saying we're valuing this as an asset. They're valuing contributions, and they find the justification for that in the divorce code. And I believe that they're interpreting that consistently with what the legislature intended.
I think that in Lundberg, which was written in 82, before Haugen, which was written in 84, both after DeWitt in 80, I think that the court, which discussed how DeWitt at great length, may not have used the terms we're overruling it, but they wind up saying that the medical degree is the most significant asset of the marriage. I'm reading from Lundberg.
Right.
It's only fair that a wife be compensated for a cost and foregone opportunities. Given the fact of this case, the trial court was within its discretion to award $25,000 to her. They go through it, and then they say it's justifiable.
Right.
They do it under, if I remember the case, maintenance.
Right. What they say at the beginning of that citation that you just read is that, in a sense, it is the most valuable asset in the marriage.
That's right.
And I think it's not saying this is an asset. It's saying it's sort of like an asset.
No, it says his medical degree is the most significant asset of the marriage. Quote.
Before that, it always says in a sense.
It's quoted in the blocks, too, and I don't think it says in a sense.
I don't find that, but, you know, we can check it through the computer and see if it says that. Doesn't say in a sense there, and they do not, I don't think, directly overrule it, but they talk at great length about other cases that don't agree with DeWitt. I think, you think DeWitt is alive and well, and I don't mean the parties, I mean the case.
Yes, and I think, you know,
that's your position.
You can certainly make an analogy between a medical degree and a more tangible asset, in that it is something that courts can value in the context of a divorce when they're looking at the statutes and applying the statutes. I don't believe that Lundberg or Haugen comes right out and says this is an asset, and I believe that DeWitt is still good law, and it's really the only case that we have that directly addresses that issue and decides it one way or the other.
Counsel, let me test your position on this asset issue by hypothetical. Sometimes you need extreme facts in order to test the premise, and that's what I'm going to do. Somewhat extreme. Your premise is that a degree or the earning capacity that comes with degrees is not an asset in cold habitation and cannot be recoverable in a just enrichment. Rather, let me rephrase that, that the degree and the earning capacity that comes with the degree is not an asset for purposes of premarital cohabitation. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, I was reading the Watts case, and it's cited to a case called Fox. I didn't read Fox, but it said, in giving the facts of Fox, that these people were married for quite some time. Well, strike that. It said, in the Fox case, she thought she was married, but she wasn't. So they were really just cohabitating. So let me spin that into a fact situation. Parties were high school sweethearts. She, after high school, doesn't get a degree. Works, you know, makes $10,000 to $15,000 a year. Puts him through undergraduate school. Then he decides he wants to be an engineer and goes to engineering school for a couple of years. Now, then he really wants to be a doctor, so he goes to his medical school, does his residency after that for internal medicine, decides psychiatry is probably what his real calling is. So he goes into psychiatry. By age 36, finally, he graduates. And he's now a psychiatrist, offering job starting at $350,000 a year at the clinic, okay? And along the way, they've had a couple of children. All the time, she's been working for $10,000 to $15,000, or let's say anywhere between $11,000 and $24,000, like the facts in this case, a year. And lo and behold, she discovers after those 18 years of living together, they're not really married. They've just been cohabiting. Under your argument, and they have no assets because he's been in school all this time and she's been raising a couple of kids with him, making $10,000 to $15,000 a year. Under your argument, the only thing that she would have available is division of any property they may have. And she would have no, under the equitable theory of unjust enrichment, under the equitable claim, she would have no recourse. Is that correct?
Unfortunately, I believe that it is correct.
How is that equity in anyone's definition?
Well, I think what you go back to is you have to look at the law of unjust enrichment.
Okay. Let's start with the law of unjust enrichment.
Right.
What are the elements of unjust enrichment?
Well, if you read the Wiley case in the context of cohabitation, it's first of all the accumulation of assets. Second of all, that the assets were retained by the defendant, that he realized that he retained the benefit. And third, that he retained that benefit to an unfair degree.
And on what did they base that definition?
It's based on the Watts case.
How can they come up with that definition when Watts specifically adopts and incorporates the jury instruction elements of unjust enrichment, which don't mention assets?
Well, I think what they were doing was tailoring it to the cohabitation situation and interpreting it and extrapolating from Watts. You have to remember, in the Waggy case, she was claiming that because she did housekeeping and because she gave up employment opportunities for him, that he owed her something. Not even alleging that he had anything to give her based on that. So I think that the court, I think, could define more clearly what the concept of a benefit is meant under the Watts case. That's what I think Waggy was doing, was saying, well, this is how we're interpreting what this concept of a benefit means.
Why is it that if you have an unjust enrichment claim involving excess freight charges, if you have an unjust enrichment claim involving property damage adjacent to Lake Michigan, if you have an unjust enrichment claim involving lost profits, if you have an unjust enrichment claim in any other context, in any other fact situation, it has the three elements that are cited in Watson that are set forth in the jury instructions. But if you have an unjust enrichment claim in the context of cohabitation, the elements are three yet, but totally different. Why?
I think that normally in unjust enrichment, you're talking about a business relationship between two parties. And I think that courts all the time take different theories, apply them to different situations, and interpret how they would apply in that specific situation. And I think it makes the law for that specific situation more clear.
And in the cases of unjust enrichment where there isn't a business relationship, how do you describe those?
Let me make an analogy. Two people live together, and one person makes $50,000 a year, the other person makes $40,000 a year. They live together for 3 years. The one person made $150,000 in that time, the other person made $120,000. This court, I think, needs to consider whether it wants to call that unjust enrichment, assuming that there is an equal amount of income being used by both parties. You've got a difference of $30,000, which one party made more than the other. So does this court want to interpret that to say that the party who made more gets to sue the other party for...
But that's not the measure of unjust enrichment is an equitable remedy for which damages are measured by the benefit conferred upon the wrongdoer and not by the aggrieved party's loss. It's not a matter of comparing who makes more.
And, well, I think in my situation, you can say that the person who made less received this benefit, and there wasn't any reason why he or she should have received that benefit of having this extra income just by virtue of the fact that her partner made more. I think the court is opening the door for cases like that between cohabitants. I have not seen one to date because I don't believe that the way that the Court of Appeals, the way that Waggy interprets unjust enrichment as it applies to cohabitants, that it would provide any relief.
Well, your red light is on, but I have a question for you, and I'm going to ask Ms. Bossert the same question. Assume, for the purposes of this question, that the court concludes that the medical degree is an asset, but that the court also concludes that it comes under unjust enrichment issues rather than divorce, family law issues. Does this have to go back to the trial court, or did the trial court, in effect, say, regardless of which way you handle it, this is what my result is, $1,700 a month?
I think that the trial court's decision on that was unclear. I think it would have to go back, at the very least, for the trial court to clarify how it was arriving at the amount for unjust enrichment. The trial court did say that 4 years of the $1,700 a month was for what happened during the marriage, and that 4 years was for what happened before the marriage. So I think it would have to go back, at least for her, to clarify that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ryan. Ms. Foster, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. What's your answer to my question?
The court, first, I don't think there'd be any point in it going back. The trial court has already indicated that a fair compensation, as Mr. Ryan indicated, for a marriage of this length without the premarital contribution would probably have been 4 years of maintenance. And I think that the trial court has already addressed that.
Your view is that as long as this is an asset, that whether you put it under 767 or you put it under unjust enrichment, the $1,700 a month is what the trial court decided.
Yes, and I would hope that this court would decide that once people are married and they're dissolving their relationship under 767, that 767 contains several provisions that you've been referring to, the whole concept of unjust enrichment. It is unnecessary to have two lines of decision. One other thing that I would like to point out, directed to Mr. Ryan's preamble quotation, that the statute only relates to things that have occurred during the marriage, I would point out that a property division does not exempt premarital property that's brought into the marriage. It only exempts inherited property. So the property element of 767.255 assumes that the court will consider the entirety of what the parties have and divide that fairly between them, and it does not limit itself to property, dividing equally property acquired during the marriage. And I think that that also is consistent with the idea that this degree can be addressed both in the area of property and in maintenance. I do further agree that DeWitt, I think this court didn't overturn DeWitt or say it specifically because it thought it was irrelevant. It would never rear its head again because now we had 767, so why would DeWitt ever come up again? DeWitt only refers to a marriage, and it very specifically says a degree is not an asset in a marriage. And this court got around reversing that by saying, well, it's really pretty irrelevant because we didn't have 767 then and we didn't have all the provisions of 767, so we don't need to reverse DeWitt. We can just say that under 767 it is an asset. Then this court went on to decide Watts, which further indicated that it would do fairness between unmarried litigants as well, and that the public policy consideration of the illicit relationship was overcome again by the need to do fairness and the need not to let one person benefit wholly while the other person remained uncompensated. And so I do believe that DeWitt is irrelevant, and the findings in the Waggy case really are pretty irrelevant and not really relevant to this court determining what is an asset as far as the degree goes. And this court has very clearly decided that a degree is an asset, and that in an unjust enrichment claim, any benefit can be compensated for under the right circumstances.
Counsel, before you sit down, is it your position that a degree can be compensated under either the statute or unjust enrichment?
In this case?
Yes.
I think that it can be, but I think that this court, I would hope this court will decide that once people are married and they proceed under 767, which is for people who are married, that the provisions of that statute would apply and that there's no reason to go to unjust enrichment because all of the elements of it can be considered under the factors of 767.
So you would not envision maintaining two causes of action?
No, because I think...
Two separate lawsuits?
No, and we did that in this case.
Different cause of action, but not different lawsuits? Did you have different lawsuits?
No, the judge allowed us to under this same case number, and that wasn't appealed. So we were proceeding under both causes of action within this file number. But I would hope that this case will determine that that's not necessary.
Just kind of a big picture question here, counsel. As the law currently stands right now, the law recognizes the marriage contract and provides legal protections upon its dissolution. The law does not recognize or provide any protections except under very narrow circumstances for non-marital cohabitation. And those very narrow circumstances are those that are articulated by the cases where one party is unjustly or unfairly holding on to a piece of property at the termination of the relationship. And there are good policy reasons for that, because why else, you know, society wants to protect the institution of marriage and not the converse. So why would we want to change that?
I don't think
it's a policy matter.
I don't think you would be changing it. I think the concept under Watts that when a specific benefit is given one party by both parties, and they're going to leave that relationship with that benefit, that they should be compensated under the unjust enrichment theory. The concept you're talking about of dependency, an award because I have become dependent on you. You have supported me, we have lived together all these years, and now I'm dependent and I have nowhere to go. That theory has no relationship to the unjust enrichment theory, which relates to me giving you a benefit. It doesn't relate to my dependency.
Well, no, I understand the conceptual distinction, but as some of the questions here have implied, you know, whichever way you do it, the outcome is the same.
I don't think that's a change in the law.
Oh, it's a significant change in the law.
I think the law is already there under Watts and under Lumberg and Haughey. Lumberg and Haughey value a degree, and Watts as an asset. And Watts has determined that when assets are accumulated between two people with the expectation of reciprocation, there will be recompense if the facts are right.
But the bottom line is that the law would be recognizing non-marital cohabitation in the same way that it recognizes marriage contributions. And that's a significant change in the law. Otherwise, we wouldn't have taken this case.
I don't agree with that. Because there are contributions to marriage other than financial and economic benefit. And 767 covers those. You can live with someone in a marriage for 20 years and make no economic contribution and still receive maintenance under 767 because of your dependency. But under the unjust enrichment statute, that isn't true. So that the marriage law, 767, provides a lot more protection than does 767 for cohabiting individuals. The only thing that Watts provides is when one person receives an economic benefit and the other person expects that they're going to be paid back and they're not paid back, then they can be paid back under Watts. It doesn't talk about cohabitation and all of the elements under 767, which have to do with just living together and throwing your lot in together. So I think that the marriage contract is a much broader contract than that defined by the unjust enrichment decision in Watts.
Just as is saying that under the old common law, when people engaged in an illegal contract, and cohabitation was illegal under the statute, in fact, criminal, the court did not come to the rescue of either side. So if one party made out very well in the sense of financial rewards from this illegal union, that party kept it. The court just stayed out of it. And the other party, if the party was disadvantaged, the court said, sorry, illegal, we're not going to help you. Now, that has been significantly changed over the years from the old common law. And in some illegal contracts, that's still probably the law, that the court will not come to the rescue of either side. In Watts, as well as in other cases, the court then said, hey, it may be illegal, but it's not right that one party be injured financially and the other party take all the rewards, and even though it's illegal, we're going to come to, the court will intervene. Now, you keep talking about Watts as just saying quantum merit, but Watts had several courses of action. Estoppel, express contract, applied contract, quasi-contract. It had several theories under which, even in what was under a common law, but may not be now, an illegal union. So, in the sense that Justice Sykes' question is saying, why should the court deal with what was formerly viewed as an illegal contract, the same as marriage? I think that question is a good one.
I think that the marriage gives a person a right under the statute to be recompensed really for failed expectations, you know, the reliance, in a way, on just being married. Whereas Watts really does, it talks about the thing beyond the romantic sexual relationship that two people acquire together and that one is going to walk away with.
So the fact that they eventually got married makes the difference?
Yes. I think it is part of what Judge Gonzalez was talking about when she said there would have been some maintenance here anyway. But I will add to that because of this 7 years where Julia supported Dr. Meyer.
Thank you, Ms. Bossert. Thank you, Mr. Ryan. That ends our hearing on...